Our general topic for this afternoon's session is the Christian in government. And the first presenter is a man who has researched this area and worked in this area for many years. Already in 1964, he published the book Church and State Under God. Most of Dr. Hughley's distinguished career has been in the area of higher education, including a term of 6 years on the Board for Higher Education Services of the Synod, 2 years as its chairman. He taught political science and history at two of our Missouri Synod institutions, St. John's Winfield and Concordia College in River Forest, and also at Northwestern University, where he received his Doctor of Philosophy degree. Later, Dr. Hughley served for 7 years as Vice President for Academic Affairs and for 10 years as President from 1968 to 1978, President of Valparaiso University. And he still serves in many areas as consultant on matters of higher education in the Synod and also in the accrediting agencies of our country. Dr. Hughley's topic today is a call to serve. Concordia Seminary is proud to count him as one of its distinguished alumni. I present the President Emeritus of Valparaiso University, Dr. Albert G. Hughley.
Thank you, Dr. Barth. It's a great pleasure to be here as part of this very fine forum and to have an opportunity again to see good friends like Dr. Nagel and Dr. Klotz and some of you whom I have known for many years, Dr. Klein, Dr. Rares, as well as some of you who are graduates of Valparaiso University and have come through here to get your theological preparation. It is always pleasant to be back on this campus because of memories that it brings and because of the associations that one has had in the past with those who have gone before. Most Americans are amateurs in politics. Fewer than half of us will vote in presidential elections, and a third or less will cast a ballot in other elections. Beyond that, we exert very little effort to participate in government, except to pay our taxes, especially at income tax time, obey laws, and express our dissatisfaction with what is going on among holders of government office. Yet many Americans do share some of the burdens of a democratic society, perhaps even more than they realize. They serve on school boards or zoning commissions, and they might even work as poll watchers or as party members. Some of you may have had these activities in the past or currently as well. When I began to put thoughts together for this occasion, I discovered upon reflection that I had been more active politically than I had assumed, while still claiming my amateur standing in politics. Over the years, I have held positions in government at every level. For example, a long time ago when I was in graduate school, I worked nights in one of Uncle Sam's post offices. Now, sorting mail may not be the most stimulating of jobs, especially after midnight, but it does provide plenty of time to reflect on governmental processes. Then there was the summer my precinct captain helped me secure employment with the road commission of a very large county. Some of you may know it as Cook County in Illinois. I was directed to take inventory of the county snowplows and other equipment. Although it was a routine patronage job, I learned a surprising amount about county government, especially when I was advised by my boss not to work so hard. Later, in a different state, I was on the board of a county mental health agency, which provided me a quite different perspective about county government services. On the state level, one governor appointed me to a constitutional commission, which was interesting, and another put me on a state water pollution control board. The latter position offered some unusual insights because the board had semi-judicial functions. My most meaningful government service, however, was at the municipal level. I was elected to serve a 4-year term on the Council of Oak Park, Illinois. That community called itself a village, but at 60,000 population, it must have been the biggest village in the world. Although I was being groomed by some friends for higher office, I say that meaning the chairmanship of the council, I moved out of state when my term ended and became a vice president and later president at Valparaiso University. Being an administrator of a university has its own kind of politics, but that's another story. I imagine that Dr. Barth could speak about politics at that level just as well as I. My reason for citing these personal experiences in government is to indicate the somewhat modest credentials I have and the background against which I shall try to handle the topic assigned me in this conference. Although after graduating from the seminary here, I became a teacher of political science and even was a co-author of a textbook in the field, I did not fully comprehend the workings of government until I had been directly involved in it. And some of these thoughts have helped me to put together the kind of message I want to share with you this afternoon, what it means to be a Christian in government. My first observation is this: a Christian has significant opportunities for service in government employment. Government positions constitute about 7% of the American workforce. Approximately 2,900,000 people work for us in the federal government, not counting those in the military. And at the state and local level, there are about 3 million employees, plus the teachers in the public schools. A large number of the government workers are under civil service. A relatively small proportion of employees of government are elected office holders in federal, state, and local government. So that when we speak of government employment, there's a wide range in which people may be engaged in services to government agencies. The men and women working for government are probably a fair cross-section of the American public. It's likely that the majority of them would even claim to be Christians. The jobs they hold are not unlike the varieties of jobs in the private sector. They have the satisfactions, frustrations, and temptations which would also be found in similar possessions with business or industry. Top-level jobs in government, whether elective, appointive, or secured by civil service examination, have broad discretionary powers. Anyone campaigning for office or occupying office by vote of the people must expect to have public attention focused upon him or her. To seek such an office, the Christian has to be equipped with the spirit of the prophet Daniel entering into the den of lions. Whatever we may think about government service, the Christian citizen, like every other citizen in a democratic society, has an obligation to do his or her part to make government work. Now, in the time of the Apostle Paul, as we know, the average person could do little more than pay taxes, obey laws, and pray for those in authority. Yet the apostle in the letter to the Romans, chapter 13, made quite a point about respecting government as the creation of God, intended to preserve order, assure justice, and look after the welfare of the civic community. The great advantages of democracy, so prized by Eastern European countries in our own day, include the privilege of the people to participate in the governance of their own lives and fortunes. Americans need to recapture some of the excitement and satisfaction of self-government, which so many people are now happily recovering for themselves. It has been said that for evil to triumph, it is only necessary for good men to do nothing. And eternal vigilance, as we know, is indeed the price we pay for liberty. But civic involvement is another price. Although the options for government service by Christians were few in Martin Luther's day, and I think it's all right to quote him in this area and in this building, his advice was characteristic of him. He said, "Should you see that there is a lack of hangmen, beadles, judges, lords, or princes, and find you are qualified, you should offer your services and seek the place." Now, I'm not sure many of us would covet the job of the hangman, but government employment was thought by Luther to provide an opportunity for a person to serve God as well as if he or she were a farmer, an artisan, or a housewife. The Augsburg Confession in Article 16 underscores this idea, saying that it is right and proper for Christians to occupy civil office, sit as judges, and so on. Underlying this sort of encouragement for Christians to hold government office is the understanding we have about the role of government itself. The church, as we all know, is God's right hand to bring salvation and spiritual nurture to God's people. The institution of government, however, is God's left hand for the earthly welfare of all of God's creatures. Government work is therefore a good work, and indeed a calling for the Christian qualified to enter it. Having been brought out of darkness into God's marvelous light in Christ, the Christian engages in his or her vocation as though by serving men in this way, he or she is serving God himself. Seen thus, government employment is exceedingly important in God's scheme of things, essential to the carrying out of divine concern for the security and well-being of all people. Too many Christians, including Lutherans, look upon government service with cynicism, indifference, or even contempt. They have tended to withdraw from such service, and this is unfortunate. If more of the committed members of the church occupied government positions and let their light shine before their fellows, as they should in any calling, they would become the role models sorely needed in politics and the government offices of the land. Now, it should be noted, of course, that working for government presents special problems which Christians and non-Christians alike must learn to confront. As you would expect, the routine of government jobs is similar to that of jobs in the private sector. The ordinariness of everyday life affects the firefighter waiting for the alarm to ring, the legislator meeting in committee, or the government executive resolving some problem of the constituents. Just as in non-government positions, it is always possible for government workers to slip into slack performance or engage in shady practices. We should understand that a great many of the decisions made by those in authority are neither black nor white in their moral implication. Letting a contract to a government supplier by itself is neither right nor wrong. A zoning board ruling is bound to please some and displease others. But as long as it is legal, it's not good or evil. The judgment of a court may fall far short of the ideal, despite the good intentions of the judge. Yet a decision has to be handed down. Government cannot exist in a vacuum. Action must be taken. Given the margin for human error and the sheer complexity of the political mechanism, it is remarkable that government functions as well as it does. It's at the discretionary area, the discretionary authority of government positions, where the most attractive options for mischief seem to be. Those who make policies in legislatures or administrative agencies, for example, may be tempted to shape things to their own advantage. Judicial bodies may follow their own biases in reaching decisions rather than remaining objective. The law may be carried out in arbitrary fashion by members of the executive branch of government. The call to serve can easily become an invitation to self-service. Misuse of power is as ancient as the history of mankind. The prophets of the Old Testament inveighed against violations of public confidence. We can all visualize the prophet Nathan standing before the throne and pointing an accusing finger at King David, saying, "Thou art the man." In the New Testament era, the venality and hypocrisy of the Jewish leaders prompted Jesus to denounce them in scathing terms. This condition has not improved very much over the course of centuries. The words of the old-time New York City boss George Washington Plunkett come to mind. He said, "I seen my opportunities, and I took them." As a village councilman, I became acquainted with one community which had paid much more for a fire engine than we did because money had to be given under the table in that city. The techniques of corruption may be more refined today than they used to be, but conflicts of interest continue to be all too prevalent in government office. For instance, many who seek public office find it very expensive to get elected and turn to the political action committees for resources. One former seven-term congressman said recently about receiving funds for his campaign, "When you take $10,000 from somebody, it's pretty darn difficult to look across the table from them and vote against something that is important to them. Or take the Watergate affair and the Iran-Contra scandals. They demonstrate how government employees sometimes use the ends to justify the means and then have no compunction about lying to the public to cover their tracks. As a result, we're close to having a crisis of confidence in the attitude of the people toward the government which they are supposed to honor and respect. The problems facing people in government take many forms. Public office is a public trust, and the missteps public officials take are all too visible because they're held to the higher standards of our expectations. If a democracy is to function well, it will need to have men and women of integrity and high commitment holding office in the public realm. The third impression, which I would like to share with you, is that the Christian in government can be an important positive force in upholding standards and values in government service. Most government employees are at least as honest and trustworthy as their counterparts in the society around them. They are, of course, helped in this direction by the laws on the books about such things as handling public funds, registration of lobbyists, the limits on campaign contributions, and similar restrictions. Fines and imprisonment may follow pursuit of private advantage which harms the public good, and that's a good way to prevent too much mischief from taking place. But the loopholes in such legislation are large. I was impressed with that as a city councilman, that there were many things that could be done which would sway the balance one way or the other, where there was no particular guideline except the conscience of the individual member of the council. The loopholes are there, and there so is the self-interest of human nature. There's an old English quatrain about the enclosure of public lands in England, and it puts it this way. The law locks up both man and woman who steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater felon loose who steals the common from the goose. Years ago in the 1950s, I recall sitting with Senator Paul Douglas in the kitchen of his home in Illinois, when he was insisting that the very nature of big government in the modern industrialized state calls for a renewed emphasis on ethics among those it employs. Now, states have begun to adopt codes of ethics to meet the need. And just yesterday, the House in the state of Missouri adopted its own code of ethics. What the Senate will do with it is something else. These codes are directed especially against conflicts of interest and the use of public funds for private gain. In 1978, Congress passed an Ethics in Government Act, supplementing it with amendments in 1983. The act applied to the entire executive branch of the federal government, but it has not been as effective as was hoped. During the Reagan administration, more than 100 of the top policymakers were involved in corruption charges. Congress has a code of official conduct for each house, too. But the record of Congress these days, from Speaker Wright to the senators caught up in the savings and loan scandals, has not been impressive. But while codes of ethics are generally prescriptive, against the abuses of the public trust, they are also symbolic. They focus on right and wrong, as well as on the positive promotion of the public good. They depend on public disclosure, accountability, and individual responsibility for competent service. Thomas Jefferson said, "The whole art of government is the art of being honest." I believe that while laws and codes may be helpful to this end, it is in the conscience of the individual that our hope for integrity in government ultimately rests. Now, to some extent, this can be achieved when people who have high internal standards are brought into office by election or appointment. If they recognize the validity of divine law written in their hearts, we have a justitia civilis. I have to put that in here. This is a seminary. Which is a sense of justice upon which organized government can depend. Christians coming into government, however, bring a perspective of special value. They have a heightened concept of their part in God's arrangement for governing men. Their outlook derives from the righteousness in Christ, which is theirs by faith. They have a different motivation for doing what their jobs require. Their commitment is to their Lord and to His directives for their lives and work. Being a Christian does not automatically qualify one for public office. Most of us would probably prefer to have a competent non-Christian in office than an incompetent Christian, no matter how pious. Government service is, after all, a secular profession. We would not want Christians to use government as a bully pulpit. You remember that expression Teddy Roosevelt used in another connection many years ago. A bully pulpit for the preaching of the gospel. That would be to confuse the functions of the state and the church, which must be structurally independent even if they interact functionally. Christians in government have to realize there can be no utopias in this life. Yet progress can be made in the improvement of the earthly realm. Christians strive for this improvement out of a concern for others, which reflects the love of God in their hearts. They are compelled by conscience to perform the duties of their office with fairness, faithfulness, and compassion. It should not be surprising, therefore, that Christians in government may have to live with ambiguity. Sometimes high goals are out of reach in public life. Some situations may require settling for proximate goals, for the penultimate rather than the ultimate, for what Governor Mario Cuomo of New York calls the plausibly possible. Senator Paul Simon of Illinois, a politician whom I've known for many years, we sat on committees, met right here at the seminary. He has deep Lutheran roots, long political experience. And he has pointed out that elected office holders face an especially difficult dilemma. They must obey the wishes of their constituents and at the same time follow their own understandings. They have a duty to do the right thing and a need to stay in office to get the right thing done. They wrestle with issues affecting a complex society, yet they must find solutions which will reconcile widely divergent elements among the people. You cannot compromise what God has told you to do and believe, Senator Simon has said. Yet I agree with him that there are many instances in which the choices to be made are not all that clearly defined. When we bought a fire engine in Oak Park, every one of us men on the council knew exactly what was needed, because we had been thinking of fire engines since we were kids. But there were other issues that we had to face that didn't have an easy resolution. And I have great sympathy for people in high office who are confronted with these dilemmas and then must make the decisions. Christians in government have one great consolation. They know that God overlooks mistakes, forgives sin, and provides strength for those who serve Him. They may stumble and falter in their calling, but they keep traveling on the same pilgrim journey as the rest of us, heading through the kingdoms of this world toward the eternal city of God. In this struggle for the relatively better, as my friend James Nichterlein calls it, we ought to have the very best kind of mind and heart at work on our common problems. One newspaper headline recently read, U.S. faces life without an enemy. For most of us in our lifetime, that's quite a switch. History is at another of its occasional turning points. We shall have to make adaptations in our economy and in our attitudes as we leave the Cold War and invest our resources in the opportunities of peace. The need for constructive leadership is clear. This is a time of great challenge for gifted people to become public servants who are at the same time dedicated servants of the Almighty God. And let our prayers go with them. Thank you.
I think you will agree that our three presentations, while all on the same subject of church and state, have approached in different ways the questions involved, first with a man in high public office, sworn to uphold the laws of the state, then from the perspective of Christian pastor, and now a challenge to all the members of the church to avail themselves of the opportunity to serve, also civil government. We invite now your questions and your comments, please. Please.
I will say something because nobody else started. I do hold 6 public offices, and I'm not bragging about it. The reason that I am holding 6 government offices is because we can't get enough people to take part in government operations or public offices like committee man of a ward or any kind of treasurer of the committee and so on and so forth.
I think if people stop to think a little bit about the opportunities available, they aren't always on the large scale, highly publicized level. And I think that many of us have these occasions where we can serve on the lower levels of government with a great sense of satisfaction and where the need is equally great. What can be achieved there in terms of government probably is more, even more significant than on the statewide or national level. And I commend anybody who gives his time for this kind of service.
Dr. Klan, please.
Mr. Chairman, this question should have been asked this morning, but I didn't have the opportunity to do that. It doesn't fit into this talk quite the same way, and yet it raises the question of a Christian working in government because of the people who oppose the idea of a Christian working in government. It began in the morning with a question about Jewish opposition to the Christian effort to prevent or, let's say, delegalize abortions. Now, if my information is correct, it could be wrong because it's secondhand. Israel has some kind of legislation against abortion. Why is it okay there and anti-Jewish if we oppose abortion? Has it ever been explored? Perhaps it should be, because it raises the question of the freedom of the Christian in society. Thank you.
Just as a comment on that, Dr. Klein, this is a problem that would be enhanced where countries, states have an established religion, a religion that is favored, and where that particular point of view becomes the prevalent and official one. And it's one of the reasons why in the Constitution of the United States, the understanding of the Founding Fathers was that they did not want to have that sort of thing going on here in this country. I think there's a difference between individuals who are in government having differing points of view. I think there's a difference between the government taking a stand because of its own points of view, because of the legislative needs and so on, and whether or not groups within the society want to support that. I think that in a democratic society, the opportunity then exists for the individual and for the group to make a change, to have a change brought about. But I don't think that the individual Christian in office should be deprived of his opportunity to express himself through groups to which he belongs or when asked for his personal opinion. As was mentioned this morning by Mr. Webster, as a sworn officer of the state, he has to fulfill the law and carry it out whether he agrees with it or not. Sometimes very hard. Sometimes he finds the law he has to carry out very foolish, and yet he has to do that. As a private citizen, he could encourage the law to be changed. But I think that that witness which he gives of his own life as a Christian, in his position, the way in which he deals with other employees in the office, the way in which he conducts his personal life, all are measures of the sort of person that he is and reflect the kind of convictions that he has in his heart. That's where the problem of corruption in government really needs to be resolved. And I think the more we have people of strong convictions, Christian convictions in office, the more likely we are to find solutions to them.
Please.
Dr. Hughley, I had perhaps first a comment and then a question about the role of political action committees. If you perhaps focus on that portion of your remarks and expand on it. My father served in the California legislature for 24 years, and after a recent campaign in which it was disclosed that two persons running for the legislature had spent over $2.5 million in a single campaign in running for that office, I asked my mom. My dad served from 1940 to 64; those were his years. How much she could recall at the very wild end, at the top end of the scale, my father had ever spent in a campaign. And did he spend $5,000 or was it ever get up to that? And she laughed and said it was never topped $2,000 during those years. Now, California is admittedly an unusual member of the union. It's not the same as all the states. And I don't mean to make the point too startling to handle in a forum like this. But the question that I have about the obvious corruptive or potentially corruptive role of money in campaigns is that is whether or not you have any thoughts about the legitimacy of the churches taking a position that would control or limit in some way the amount of contributions that may be made to a candidate for political office. And if so, on what basis, in Christian teaching, would you commend that activity? And if you don't, Then how do we get to resolve your question about finding good candidates to run for office?
Probably the biggest problem in politics, certainly elective politics today, has to do with the costs of campaigning, the cost of getting into office and being reelected. Figure of some 89 or 90% of the incumbents of Congress being reelected tells you that it's easier to get there and to stay there. It's easier to stay there than to get there. And part of it is due to the fact that the costs of advertising your campaign are so high. That's in turn related to the cost of television, the cost of advertising, and so on and so forth. These costs have worried legislators for many years, and various efforts have been made to put a ceiling on the amount that can be spent. And that's, of course, been tried without too much success because there are ways of getting around that. The political action committees, the PACs, as you see them written up in the papers, are avenues by which interest groups bring their pressures to bear by providing substantial funding for candidates in re-election. All right, now what does one do about that? What can Christians do about that? First of all, I think Christians have to be informed about them. One of the sad things is that so many people, not only Christians, but non-Christians too, don't know too much about how government really runs. But they have to be informed. How does a person who runs for office get elected? How does he defray his expenses? Once he knows that, he may disagree with the ways in which individuals do receive their compensation or their resources for getting elected. And he may then bring pressure to bear as a citizen to get a modification in the laws, which is his certainly his right and privilege to do. Indeed, his obligation, if he feels strongly about it. I'll let his congressman know we want to change this law so that people can't spend more than X dollars, or that no one can contribute more than X dollars, or whatever the pattern may be. And I think it's in this sense that Christians ought to be more aroused to their civic obligations and duties. They have to run for office. But I think it would be well to know what happens so that if you're not happy from a moral point of view, from a conscience point of view, with what is being done, you take the avenues and follow the channels which will affect a change, which can bring about a more adequate and efficient form of representative government that we have in this country. Ed Gaffney and I have, by the way, it's the new dean of the law school starting July 1 at Valparaiso University. So I'm looking to him to have the answers, which I will leave here on the floor unanswered, since lawyers are supposed to know all these answers anyway. But he and I have been at many conferences, some of them that he has run himself, on this whole issue of church and state. And if anything comes through, it is that Christians, A, have to know enough about what government is and how it operates, and B, what are the avenues by which they can bring about change if they want changes to be effected. Now, when it comes to groups, the church has every right to express itself within its sphere. For the church as church to decide that a certain sewer should be laid in a certain way, I think that's out of its sphere. But it's a moral issue. It could express itself on the moral issue. And I think that those are some of the distinctions that we need to know about and to learn how to use effectively in government.
This really is a question and not an opinion. I was taught when I was in Bible college that if you want something done in the church, find the busiest man and ask him to do it. And I'm wondering if the churches have not been at times guilty of drawing off the time and talent of the very best people so that they don't feel they have the time to be the committee man or involved in politics.
Well, I would say that's... I don't think that those who are on boards or are responsible for filling vacancies on boards in the church would necessarily agree that the church is drawing off all the top talent. They feel they could get a whole lot more there. But I think it doesn't take a whole lot of talent for people to go into even the modest levels of public service. We're not talking here about the kinds of responsibilities a statesman ought to have. I better use that word carefully. A statesman is a dead politician. But we're talking here about persons who have a stake in the community and therefore can give some time to help resolving these things. Working on a parking or traffic commission is certainly the kind of thing the average individual can do without a vast amount of preparation. He runs into those frustrations every day. And I think there are more people who can get involved at lower levels than they think they'd have to get involved in if they were going to move in that direction. But I agree with you. We expect a great deal, but unless we expect the highest, we don't get the highest. And I think our people, Christian people, are very capable of giving it.
Mr. Malik, please.
Christians in government service have to, I believe, go by their moral convictions, and they also have to obey the laws or have to carry out the laws of the jurisdiction which they're serving. I wonder, in a situation, say, for instance, Governor Cuomo, who says that he himself is against abortion, yet he still says that he feels that the individual has the right to an abortion, knowing that he is a Christian and knowing the position of his church, I would assume that this would be a deep moral Christian conviction on his part that abortion is wrong. I wonder if you would comment on this apparent dichotomy.
Yeah, that's one of those ambiguities with which a conscientious person has to wrestle. Governor Cuomo is essentially saying that you have to, when you assume public office, fulfill your obligations of office. And if the obligations call for the enforcement of a certain kind of law with which you are not necessarily in agreement, then your choice comes down to either resigning from office or from fulfilling the law and protesting about it as much as you can. I think that it's a dilemma which every person in public life faces, but it's not unlike what a person faces in private life. There are a lot of decisions that company executives have to make, which for the sake of the company they take, but they are not themselves entirely happy with it. And that's true not just at the top level, but all the way through wherever there's discretionary authority. That's why sometimes it's necessary to settle for that which is not quite ideal. Now, in this case that you're citing, of course, you have a very, it's not just a goal, you've got a very sharp dichotomy between the two positions. But he has plenty of precedent, say he has to fulfill the law in his way, even though he doesn't necessarily agree with it in his own heart. I was hoping the Archbishop May would be here in the audience and would pick that up this afternoon. Oh, he's here. Fine. I leave something for him to take care of. Would you ask the same question of him?
If I can follow up on that, Dr. Hughley, you mentioned that Christians should not refrain from seeking governmental positions because of the dangers of mischief and corruption. That, of course, is a temptation that comes not only to Christians, but to non-Christians as well. But where, citing now Governor Cuomo's position, would you like to expand on where are the areas of tension and conflict, aside from the obvious things of bribery and corruption, where are the areas of tension for the Christian in fulfilling his role as Christian and Christian citizen or Christian leader? Want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I think one of the areas that comes to mind at the moment is expenditures in the public realm, let's say, for public welfare purposes. a Christian can feel very much concern about both wanting to do something for his fellows and still expenditure of funds which take the resources from other of his fellows who may need them just as much in a different way. Or the issues that have to do with how much shall government be involved in the lives of individuals. And again, a Christian has to evaluate that in terms also of individual responsibility. There are too many things which would propel him to do something for large groups because of the potential of having large numbers of voters say, that's the fellow we want to have back into office. And he may have to take a stand on an issue which will make it difficult for him to become reelected because a number of constituents are going to say, we can get something out of him, out of his replacement, much better than we can from him. I'll give you a little example, and I'll cut this short. A friend of mine is Bill Beeney. Some of you may remember him. He was a member of the Board of Directors of Synod and was representative from Southern, one of the congressional districts in Southern Indiana, around Evansville. Bill Beeney was in office in the years prior to Pearl Harbor, and he had served his people well. And there was a time right before Pearl Harbor where the issue came up, some of you may be able to remember that, the issue came up whether or not Selective Service should be renewed. Remember Selective Service? And this is peacetime, but things were getting uncertain in Europe, and Selective Service had been unpopular, but it had passed. Now came the question, should it be renewed? And he went back to his district and talked to the farmers and businessmen in his district and said, what do you think? How would you like me to vote on this? The overwhelming numbers of them said, we don't want that renewed. Have our boys drafted and so on. All right. He went back, cast his vote against it, and about a month or two later, well, then came a very close vote in the Congress, and it passed. About a month or two later came Pearl Harbor. Well, shortly after that, there was another congressional election, and Bill Beeney went back to be reelected. It was about his 14th year, seventh or eighth term. He was asking to be sent back. He was then a minority leader in the House on one of the major committees, and very important. And he talked to his voters, and they say, Bill, we like you, but you know you voted wrong on this elective. Where would we be now if your point of view had prevailed and Selective Service had been dropped? That wasn't good. So they didn't vote for him, and he had to get out of office. See, that's one of those things. His conscience may have told him to vote for it. His constituents didn't want to vote for it. Which way should he go? Small example, but a significant one. Incidentally, after that, he had more time to spend on government boards and committees.
Well, I was wondering, from a more practical point of view, you talk about getting people involved here, and I had three cases that I can think of, and I know there are others, where we look at and set up maybe false dichotomies. We have a city of God situation where church and state are somehow molded. Then we have the reverse, which is an us against them. And now it seems more of almost a fatalism with a false eschatology even, where so many Christians think the end times are drawing nigh. Why should we even worry about this? Let's build an ark and get aboard. How do we, as pastors and seminarians in the midst of this, motivate our people through the gospel to take on these oft-times thankless tasks?
Well, it would be like saying to a person with the end times drawing near, why bother bringing up your children? They won't need to have any guidance because the end times are so close that you might as well mark time. Let them grow up like weeds. Pretty soon, they won't have to become adults. I think that, who was it, Martin Luther who said, whatever the conditions of the times may be, you plant a tree and wait for the fruit to come. even if you think it's not going to come. You're going ahead and plant the tree anyway. You need to get across to them the admonition of the Lord to be busy until he comes. And I think in this case, individuals who have obligations outside of the home, who have obligations to church, who have obligations to their neighbors, also have obligations to their country. So that their obligations, they should prompt them to fulfill their job until the trumpet blows. And I think that if you look at it in a larger perspective, I think this is just one more of those duties that the individual assumes which he should be carrying on regardless of the potential of the end having an imminence to it. We walk in the shadow of eternity and know that, but it still is incumbent upon us to live our lives as though they were to be stretched out into the indefinite future. And I think that's true in the kind of country in which we live particularly.
Yes, you apparently have answered them all, and we thank you again. Before we dismiss, and we'll have an extra 15 minutes, you're once again invited, should you so choose, to go to Wartburg for our coffee break. I will take this opportunity for the benefit of those going to the banquet tonight to remind you of the time as it is listed in the program, which is different from the originally scheduled time. Our reception this evening is at 5:45, and the dinner banquet will be served at 6:30. So your program is correct, but it varies from what was originally forwarded to you by mail. So again, Dr. Hughley, we are very grateful for your presence. We wish you God's continued blessing in your work as consultant. Let us thank him again.